Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World Thursday webinar on the 18th of June 2020, and I'm your host Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Hawkins, also known as @Hawkeye_78 on Twitter. Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about your career background and then how long you've been investing and if that's in bonds and equities.
Hi, Tamsin. Thank you very much for having me on. I just wanted to start by saying that I think the work that you and Tim and people like David at Mellow and ShareSoc is absolutely brilliant. So I'm hopefully here to give a little bit of something back on something I know a fair bit about. So my career history, I graduated in the mid-90s with absolutely no idea what I wanted to do apart from a vague interest in finance. I actually had a job lined up on a cruise ship. I had visions of being Tom Cruise in Cocktail. But the gentle guiding hand of a parent in my father pushed me into applying to be a stockbroker. I was successful in that application and started as a graduate trainee stockbroker in 1996. And it was literally like a light switch was flicked. I just found this world absolutely fascinating. At about the same time, I realized if I was going to do this, I really wanted to be in the city. I heard about it. It just seemed so exciting. So I set about getting myself into the city. I think it was 44 applications and so many interviews and so many assessment days before I actually got a job offer, which I got from Royal Bank of Scotland. I also got one from Deutsche Bank. I chose Royal Bank of Scotland because it was a very structured program. So I started as a graduate trainee with no real idea about what they did. I went round various departments and spent time with them all, the economics department. So I worked for a future MPC member and FX markets. And at about the same time, they were starting up what was called the Sterling Fixed Income Bond Market operation, which was the aspiration of RBS to get into bond markets in a bigger way. I, like other graduates, rotated there and was lucky enough to be offered a role there. So I started with them in 1999 and it was just mind blowing. I started on the desk and I just couldn't believe that there were these millions and millions of pounds flowing through the desk every single day. The risk that they were taking, the clients that they were engaging with, just the numbers were just so vast. I couldn't almost comprehend it. I stayed at RBS till 2009. Along the way, we built a business out of which I was a part of, which was probably the biggest sterling credit market maker on the street. We were the biggest risk taker. We were the go-to business for every single asset manager that cared in our product, which was so exciting to be involved in. By the time I left, I was the head of sterling credit trading. Along the way, I'd managed to get myself to be the chairman of the Euro Sterling Steering Committee, which dealt with matters pertaining to the sterling market. Probably a highlight in retrospect now was being part of helping the BOE design the corporate bond element of quantitative easing in 2009, going into the Bank of England on Threadneedle Street and sitting in the rooms and talking to them how they were going to do it. It was just an incredible time with what was going on sort of in the real world away from it as well. However, by 2009, Barclays had been flirting with me for quite some time and persuaded me by headhunting me to go and run a business there. At Barclays, I was the head of sterling credit trading. I was also head of European ABS, which is asset-backed securities and commercial paper trading. By 2011, I was headhunted again as part of a push by Santander to build out a global investment bank. And I was mandated to build a UK credit and sales operation. So I ran UK credit and sales and trading out of London. Genuinely exciting to be part of that project. But by 2014, I don't think I'd had breakfast at home because most people are in by 6:37 every morning. And I just wanted to do things a bit differently, wanted to apply what I'd learned and started my own asset management firm with a view to potentially launching a hedge fund. And I've been doing that ever since.
And what actually is a bond? What are the key facts we should understand as a starting point?
The first thing I need to acknowledge is all the slides you will see, or the majority of them with the black backgrounds, are Bloomberg. Bloomberg is the definitive source. I appreciate most people don't have it, and it's a little bit unfair to show you what you don't have or willing to pay for because it's very expensive, but it really is just the best source. It's not the only source. Google is fascinating. Below the Bloomberg screen is actually the London Stock Exchange quote. There's C-bonds, there's issuer websites, stockbrokers. There's all sorts of information everywhere. So that's the first thing to say. The other thing to say is the coverage in mainstream media is absolutely terrible of bonds, and people's knowledge of bonds generally is very low grade that you hear commentating on in the mainstream media. So I'd almost discount that. So what is a corporate bond? It's simply an agreement to borrow money for a set period of time at a set interest rate. A company or issuer will issue a bond. An investor will be attracted by the yield on offer, and the two will meet and they will issue the bond, and the bond will be bought by the investor. Everything is determined at issue, but the world changes. As soon as it's issued, yields change, prices change, events happen like COVID. So everything changes immediately as soon as it started being issued. So if we look at this first bond here, I chose this bond, Hammerson, because it's a bond that I've spent a lot of my career trading in and out of, and I've got a great fondness for it. It was issued originally in 1998 at a 7.25% yield. Government bond yield at the time relative to that was 5.95% on the underlying government bond. I'll come back to that, so don't worry about that at the moment. So it's a 30-year bond when it was launched. What actually can you see here? You can see a 7.25% coupon. What that means is that for every £100 you invest, you get £7.25 a year, and hopefully in 2028 you get your £100 back and a final coupon payment of £7.25. Now, that bond is currently trading at a cash price in excess of par, so it's giving you a current yield of 6.75%. Remember, everything's determined at launch. So the type of bond is determined. We're talking here about plain vanilla corporate bonds. That, if you just keep that in mind, that this is the most plain of vanilla bond that's out there. This tells you here it's a senior unsecured bond. What exactly does that mean? Senior means it's senior to equity and senior to other subordinated bonds. Unsecured simply means it you don't have any recourse on any assets that the issuer might be willing to put against it. In this case, they weren't. There were £200 million of bonds issued. The minimum increment is £1,000. So if a private investor wanted to buy £1,000 of this bond, you could phone a stockbroker today. Say, I'd like to buy £1,000. What's your price? And they would give you that price. And then you'd receive £72.50 for the next 8 years and £100 back at the end. The great thing about bond markets is that there are the things called the rating agencies. The rating agencies, which have come in a lot of criticism over the years because of various events, mostly CDO related, but they tell you what exactly is the likelihood of default. And what that's telling you here, that Fitch, one of the three main agencies, are saying it's BBB+. That means it's investment grade because it's above BBB. And therefore, the likelihood of default is actually quite low. But you can mathematically work out the default probability. And there are also many statistics out there about what the probability of a bond you buy at BBB+ would be in defaulting. The other thing that's determined at launch are the covenants. Now, we're hearing a lot of chat about covenants breaches and current covenant waivers at the moment. What that actually means is that equity holders and every equity holder is reliant on people like bondholders agreeing to waive a covenant. Let's say it was a net debt to EBITDA. You've got other kinds of covenants, interest cover, negative pledge is related to other types of borrowing, and cross default. Change of control is the one that used to keep me awake most at night, because LBOs in the 2000s were a big thing, and that meant leveraging up, which meant lots of bond issues. So bonds moved a lot on any kind of story like that, and that resulted in the evolution of covenant language. But what that actually means in reality is you know from the start what happens if something goes wrong and what can go wrong. So if they default on one of those covenants, that gives you the information as to why they would default. The prospectus really is the key thing. Prospectus can run to 700-800 pages, but there are only a few pages where the actual detail is there. Now, when I first left the city, I determined that any bond I would ever buy post being in the city, I'd read the covenant, the prospectus. I took myself off to the libraries. It seemed the quietest place, and rather strangely, there's a strange smell in there. I read all 700 pages, and this guy who's sitting next to me kept looking at me, and it turned out he was a tramp and trying to figure out why I was reading this big document when I got chatted to him. So that ended my events of going to the library to read a prospectus, but I still now will look through our prospectus and try and get a very good understanding of what I'm buying.
I gather the credit spread is the key concept to understanding the corporate bond market. What is the credit spread?
Yeah, it's what you actually need to know. In short, There is a graph at the top of that page, which I used to draw for any graduate who started with me to explain what we were actually doing on the desk. It was probably explained to me by one of my first bosses. The key concept, and the same bond is below it, sorry. This key concept is that the only way you can judge relative value of a corporate bond is based on its yield relative to the government bond to which it trades to. So what that means is every government bond has a benchmark to which it trades to, which is determined at launch. So you can see on here, the Hammerson bond trades to the UKT 6% of 2028 bond, and that gives the yield on the government. And what you can see there is that that yield minus that yield gives the spread difference, which is 6.6% or 660 basis points. The spread will tighten if news is good, or it will widen if news is bad. And what you can see in this upper chart here is it's a fictional government bond yield curve with time and yield going up the side, time there. This represents the where a government bond might trade for 15 years. And in this fictional world, it trades at 5% today. And if XYZ PLC issuer to come along and it's triple re-rated, there might be agreement that 200 basis points over the government bond would be where it would be fair and reasonable for that bond to be issued. So that would result in a 7% coupon for a 2035 maturity. That's the absolute key of the market, is that the market is a spread-based market. So when I was sitting in a bond trading desk, I would get the likes of Prudential, Legal & General, so on and so forth, come on and ask me where a bond would trade. And let's say they came on and asked me Hammerson, I would say 660 to 650, as in I would buy at gilts plus 660 and sell at gilts plus 650. And then we would enter a negotiation in which they would tell me what they want to do. And it might be buy 10 million, sell 20 million, might be less, but that would be how it would evolve from there. There is no discussion of price with investment grade corporates until the point in which you agree to execute. Credit traders, as in what I was, will isolate the credit risk, because this bit below the line on the upper chart is not what I'm mandated to take risk in, because that's moving as much. I mean, when this bond was issued, this Hammerson bond was issued in 1998, the yield on the 30-year bond was 5.95%. Now, I'm pretty sure if anyone could get government risk for near 6%, they'd be buying it all day long at the moment. Most investors as well, and this is a common misnomer, will be hedging the interest rate risk too. So they're just taking spread risk and not taking, they will have a different area which will be taking rate risk. In terms of complexity, the terms like modified duration, convexity, I will lose you all. So I think we'll just sort of breeze over those. But what you've got here is an example in the bottom right of a spread chart. And you can see things were going quite nicely in 2020. The spread over the government bond was about 200 basis points, reflective of where credit risk was for that issuer. COVID struck, everything went wrong. Hammerson has serious concerns about the getting paid its rental income. So the spread blew out to 700 basis points, which meant you could get a very attractive yield. It's now down a little bit back, but that equates to 6.75%.
But that still seems quite low for the risk that you're taking, doesn't it?
Well, you have to put it in context. You are ranking above equity. You are senior unsecured. So if it was to default, let's just say that every tenant refuses to pay their rent, you still have recourse to assets on the balance sheet once people above you have been repaid. So usually the liquidator and the HMRC get their money first, but Hammerson bondholders would have a claim on the real assets, which will be, you know, you might have issues about it being a property, but equity holders don't get paid out until the bondholders have got their money out.
Interesting. So how big is the bond market?
In short, absolutely massive. It's described as the big brother of the equity market in its entirety with government bonds. It just dwarfs the equity market. I haven't got stats, but the stat I found, front page of the FT a couple of weeks ago, was about UK equity raises being 10 billion. And it was, you know, it was newsworthy, all the Compass groups and people, so on and so forth. As of the same point, sterling corporate bond issuance was 105 billion by that same point. We've seen 1 trillion of US corporate bonds issued since March. That's $1 trillion. I mean, it's just eye-watering numbers. Amazon last week issued a $10 billion series of deals, 3 to 40-year maturities. They upsized it because the demand was $32 billion. Yesterday, BP launched 12 billion of hybrid bonds, which are a different type of bond, but they're more like equity, but they can launch 12 billion in a day. In short, there is something for everyone in the bond market. You shouldn't feel there is any limitation. If you want to take risk in bonds, of which I'm an advocate that people should be doing, you can buy government bonds, you can buy index-linked government bonds, you can buy corporate index-linked if you're worried about inflation. If you want financial risk, you can buy senior subordinated, you can buy CCDS, which is building society equity-like structure, you can buy additional tier one, which is almost equity in banks, you can buy debentures where you actually know the security you have and you can enforce that security, you can buy zero coupon if you actually don't want that income, you want it rolled up right to the end, or you can buy asset-backed if you want to look at the actual underlying assets in a similar way to a debenture. If you look around the world, wherever you go, be it on a motorway, through a hospital, in an airport, or travel on a train, it will most likely be financed by a bond.
So what's the process of issuance of a bond and how's it priced?
Well, bond issuance is probably one of the bigger businesses in the city, in the bond market. It's an absolutely massive business. Sorry, I should say that picture is from 2003. I'll come back to it, but most people's attention is drawn to one thing, which I can explain. But it's a massive business. It's extremely competitive. There are enormous fees to be making. We're talking about banks making hundreds of millions of pounds out of this business every year. So how it operates is a three-stage process. The origination occurs primarily, which is basically the bank discussing with an issuer, be it whoever, be it BP or Legal in general, what kind of bond they want to launch. And if the company or the issuer wants to offer security, that will get them a lower interest rate because it's less risky. If they don't want to offer security, they might want to issue a certain type of bond, or they might want to. So in 2000s, pubs were very popular to be securitized because everyone thought they were just a no-brainer, that those cash flows would keep rolling in from pubs. Similarly, in 2012, banks decided they wanted to issue ultra low risk bonds, which were called covered bonds. So that market exploded out of nothing. So that's decided. It's then passed over to the syndication department, which is essentially the process of bringing it to the market. And that it all but is pricing and allocation. So what happens is there are calls made to investors, all the big names, you know, Legal in general, M&G, so on and so forth. And there will be a chatter about, oh, we're bringing this bond. At this moment, it's private, so I wouldn't know this was existing. And they'll say, we're thinking about issuing a bond for Glaxo. We're thinking about £1 billion issue. We're thinking about a 4% yield. And investors would say, oh, probably not enough spread to the government, blah, blah, blah. And it would go backwards and forwards. So then they would go live with it. There'd be road shows. There'd be lots of discussions. Management would make themselves available. And then it would eventually result in a book build. And if the bond is successful, there will be orders in excess, like Amazon the other day. The order book was three times the size of the issue. And then it will go to allocation. There's various discussions about pricing all along the way. So yesterday, Legal in general came out and announced that they were issuing a bond. And the initial price talk was 6.25%. Because of the demand, they ended up pricing it at 5.625%. And the book was oversubscribed. And it's since rallied since it became free to trade. So that's kind of the process. That's a successful launch. If it fails, and we've had a fair few failures, there was one, Endesa, the utility, Spanish utility, brought a bond, and I think we sold five of 200 million, and we had to keep it a secret, and every day I had to mark that P&L, and we were losing a lot of money every day on that till we actually sold it down. And then once it's launched and priced, it enters my world, which was secondary trading. So what you can see here is actually, that's me on the phone. You can see this is actually us probably in the middle of doing some kind of trade. The things I've pointed out, because I think this might be of interest to a few people, is the hoot and holler, which is when a bond's launched or any bond's trading, the microphone you can see here, I can broadcast, or my colleague who's sitting there, who's my boss at the time, can broadcast to the whole of London, everyone who works for Royal Bank of Scotland. We can broadcast to New York salespeople. We can Asia, Singapore, Hong Kong. We can tell them all what we want to do. And we'd be shouting out spreads and getting people to deal. If anything exciting is going on, everyone wants to know, and generally the market will be full of chatter about it. So we'll be shouting down there. You can see here this dealer board. We've got lines to every significant client that we speak to, and they're open all the time, so we can just talk at will. There's no need to make a phone call. On the screens, we've generally got prices where we can deal within the market. We'll be looking at our risk. We'll be looking at our positions. And then obviously the reading matter at the bottom. I actually didn't buy that. I truthfully didn't touch it because it was a result of a bond issue from EMAP, who came round and gave us all a keepsake of their bond that they just launched. They were the publisher of FHN at the time. I'm sure it was in preference to the FT on that day, but that's why it was there.
And can you explain to us the ORB, the LSE order book for retail bonds, and the difference to the wider corporate bond market?
The ORB was a brilliant development. And the history of the ORB is that in continental Europe and Italy, retail participation in the corporate bond market is far higher. There is just a culture of bond ownership. And the LSE, amongst others, realized that there was a potential to build out a market and generate revenue from it. So it's 2010. There was a great big push. I was in a small part of it. And what we found was that quality issuers came to the market. Tesco was the example. And they gave investors essentially a free pass because they issued a really cheap bond just to get demand. It actually caused quite a lot of problems for us at the time at Barclays, because one investor wanted to buy the whole issue and nearly actually refused to deal with us again because we wouldn't sell it. But the retail investors who got that got a great deal. What since happened from then is government policy and regulation have served to work against it. There's no intentional consequence, no intentional reasons why, but they just did. Events like minimum denomination, MiFID II and Lloyd's CoCos, resulting in a ban on private investors owning subordinated financials without agreeing to reduce their risk level. Significant events. And what that's led to is less of a focus, because if you are a Tesco nowadays, you can launch probably £1 billion issue with four or five phone calls because you know all your bond investors. Whereas if they were to issue in the retail market now, they'd have to do a roadshow, they'd have to make themselves available. But more significantly, the documentation that MiFID II requires them is so vast. So the unintended consequence of this is the issue quality, in my opinion, has gone down quite substantially. That's not to say people issuing now, issuers aren't good quality, but they're not as good quality as they were. And I think anyone who looks at a new issue on the ORB should look at it and try and understand exactly why somebody wants them, where they want their money. So I think it's fair to say that the ORB was a great innovation, but it's only a tiny fraction of the tradable market. But for any private investor, it's a great starting point. But you can potentially get much better value elsewhere. And any new issue, you should be asking yourself why they want your money and what they're going to do with it. So say, for example, Wasps, the rugby club, launched a bond. The first thing I'd be thinking is, why do they want my money? What's, you know, and how indebted are they? I'd be worrying about that. And a real example is I intended to do lots of reading this morning so I could sound very learned, but I was actually trading a bond of which they have an issue on the ORB. Provident Financial Group have a 5 1/8 2023, which is issued in 2015. It yields 8%, but there is a non-ORB version of that bond with the same maturity, 2023, a higher coupon, and that's yielding over 11%. So that gives you an idea that the ORB should be a starting point from a standing start, but it's not the end of the world, as it were.
So where do we find the other issues that aren't on the ORB as retail investors?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would do from a standing start would be think about talking to your stockbrokers. There are retail market makers. There are things called agency brokers who will intermediate, and they will be a good source of information. But I mean, the power of Google is second to none. Issuer websites. So say, for example, you wanted to look at Tesco. If you own the Tesco retail bond now, which I think is coming due for maturity, you thought, I want to buy more Tesco risk. You could go on Tesco and you could see every bond they've ever issued and what form and it takes.
And what drives the price of the corporate bond in the secondary market?
In short, it's exactly the same as the equity market. Corporate bonds are a similar instrument. Events determine what causes a bond to move relative to everything else. You've the bottom chart there is of AA bond. I picked that because I know there's been a lot of chatter about equity the AA equity. I'll come back to that in a minute. But say, for example, you take Burford, the Muddy Waters story had a similar impact on the bonds, which collapsed on the back of the story. But the bond market is looking at it in a different way. They're looking at it from the point of view of solvency. You're trying to figure out whether you get your money back at the end of the day. Similarly with AA, you are trying to figure out whether you get your money back. So that brings me on to what determines the corporate bond price. There are three elements. The first is your credit risk, which you have idiosyncratic issuer risk, as in Burford or AA both have individual risk that drives them exactly the same as it would their equity. But you also have the market risk, again, the same as the equity, that if the world is getting worse, credit spreads will generally widen, or they will react with events. So if there's not an individual event moving them, credit spreads generally will move them. And then finally, as if you think back to that chart I showed you earlier, you have the rate risk, that interest rates are changing. Now, I certainly don't have a view on where rates are going, but it's been the wrong trade to bet against rates falling for the last 35 years. If we take, for example, this bond, AA bond, this is part of a whole business securitization, which ranks senior to the equity. So for you to lose money on this, you need equity to be wiped out in most cases. They issued senior and subordinated bonds. This bond you can see here is 2022. It's got a 5.5% coupon. So it's senior to the equity, but it's subordinated to other bonds in issue. What happened come in February, they were talking about refinancing it. Come to COVID world, everyone got very worried about credit spreads generally, which was a market phenomenon. But they were also worried about AA being able to refinance because it's a highly leveraged business at 9x EBITDA, I think it's running at. So that yield got up to 25% in late March. So you could buy that bond and get 25% a year till 2022, then get your £100 back if it can be refinanced. But there were serious questions, obviously. The yield is giving you a clue that that wasn't clear cut. It's now rallied. I think it's just a bit below 14%. It's more like 13% now. What that's saying to you is there's still worries about refi risk, but they're far less than they were. And whilst, I mean, that yield should be giving you pause for thought. In the case of AA, I think they will be able to refinance it. So if you agree with that view, you can lock in 13% and have to do very little from now to 2022.
And did you buy AA?
No, I did. I bought RAC for the reasons that I like the story, but I liked the less leveraged version in RAC. I was quite happy that there was second placed player in the market. It's only 6x levered, and I bought RAC when this was at about 17%. I bought RAC at 13% because I just think it's a far more likely that there is no problem in refinancing that. And they'd also issued some loans to banks to basically prepare for the refinancing of it. So I just thought that was a relative value trade. But I was looking at AA this morning thinking, have I missed this, and really trying to think through it again. But again, it comes back to, am I going to get my money back?
And as a retail investor, what do we need to know to buy bonds?
Well, the first thing to know is it's less risky than equity. It's an investment that should, in all cases, allow you to sleep better at night. In a world where dividends are now incredibly constrained, remember your bond issuer that you would buy into is contractually obligated to pay you that coupon that you bought in at. So if you take a view that your dividend income and you need to replace that, then you can go up what's called the capital structure, have less risk, and then still get a yield. So that's probably the main driver that a retail investor should be potentially thinking about. I think it's fair to say that you need to think about the world differently. It's an exercise in looking differently. You have to come to the concept of, will I get my money back? Like, why do they want my money if it's a new issue? Or if you take Hammerson as an example, what could go wrong for Hammerson? It's pretty obvious what could go wrong, but how likely is that? I think it's fair to say you can suit any risk appetite in the bond market, exactly the same as the equity market. You know, you can buy oilers, you can buy the most low risk government bond, 1 year T-bill or 3 month T-bill, or you can buy extremely long dated, extremely risky assets, be they shale gas producers in the US, and probably get theoretically a 40-50% yield, and all you have to do is get them to repay, but you have to satisfy yourself that that's going to happen. As I said, the orb is a fraction of the market, but it's a great starting point. I think the rating is a great clue in terms of where you should potentially start. Now, the rating agencies, you can get stuff on their websites. You can quickly deduce what a company is rated by general, the same way you would in an equity market. I would be thinking about, again, like I said, why do they need my money? So the advent in the orb of things like WASPs. I mean, is WASPs as good as Tesco? I know nothing about WASPs, but I'd rather give my money to Tesco. I think retail charity bonds are an interesting evolution. But again, why do they need your money? That's the key question. And more, how likely are you to get your money back? If I was looking for ideas, I might come from a bottom-up approach. I might be saying, well, AA, Burford, Hammerson, property companies. I've got a load of bank equity. It now doesn't pay me a dividend. I want to replicate some kind of income. I might go and look at quasi bond, quasi equity instruments in the bank market. So for example, Nationwide have what's called a CCDS. Don't worry about what it stands for, but it's essentially equity. But the FCA said they could continue paying that. It's less risky than the, obviously Nationwide doesn't have an equity, but it would be theoretically less risky than the equity. I might also look from a sectoral base. I might be thinking, well, I want to look at property. I think the property market is going to recover. So if you take that bond that I picked just at random, Hammerson, 6.75%, it's greater than the dividend yield I was getting on XYZ. I'm going to get my money back. So I'm quite happy because the rating agency says it's, you know, it's the likelihood of default is quite low. Whether that is true or not, the world is evolving. So the rating agencies can only react with what they know now. In terms of how you trade it, it's the same as trading an equity, albeit you probably can't do it in most cases online. You would have to phone up. Most stockbrokers will tell you they know what they're talking about, but you'll quickly realize they don't. If you ask them for a specific bond, be it a Provident Financial or Hammerson, they will go away and get you a price. They might go to, you have to remember, you won't be speaking to institutional market makers like I was. They'll be speaking to retail market makers or agency brokers who will go and try and source them the bond. But they will go and do the work for you and come back. Now, probably one of the most significant things that most people are completely unaware of is qualifying corporate bonds or QCBs. Now, if a bond is a QCB, which most plain vanilla corporate bonds are, if you buy that bond and it has a capital gain from when you purchased it, let's say AA, you were purchasing it at 60p in the pound and you got 40 pence of capital gain, that would be tax-free. So that's a significant benefit that doesn't exist in the equity market. If you were to hold bonds in ISAs or SIPs, you don't generally have an issue from withholding tax, but it's always worth just double-checking that they don't have to pay tax before you actually get the coupon, but almost all of them don't. So you get the full coupon benefit. A lot of people are phased by accrued interest, finally. All that is simply that if I buy a bond of PI World today, you've earned interest up to the point in which I buy it. So I need to give you that interest that you rightfully deserve. But I think the main thing is, it is an exercise in looking at how I can get my money back, most importantly. But if it's a new issue, read the actual document. You can't underestimate. You need to think why they want your money.
And I've heard you talking about haggling with the market maker, but if we're spending a few thousand and not a few million, are we really in a position to be able to haggle with the market maker on bonds?
Well, I think it's worth saying it's a negotiated bilateral market. So it's not something that you will shock. So if someone gives you a price, they will give you a price. They won't give you a spread. They'll be gentle. So let's say they offer you 100 and they're saying that it's 95, 100. You've got nothing to lose. The market maker or the agency broker won't be shocked by you going back, and nor should they be offended. They can only say no. And if you've got a line in the sand, then there's no reason why you have to, just pay what they say. However, I mean, I spent my career being a dick for a tick, and the bond that I bought today, I could have bought 4 points lower last week. So there comes a point when, I mean, with something like Burford, when it was moving very quickly on the muddy water story, the market maker gave me a price and I reacted to it without haggling at all, because I knew that there was a lot of interest in the story and it would move as soon as I put the phone down. So I think it's time and a place.
And what are the key things that can go wrong with a bond investment?
In short, default. That's the worst thing that can happen, is that if you've given that company your £100 and you're expecting £7.25 back a year, all of a sudden a default occurs and then you are into a process of recovery. There is a working assumption that in the senior unsecured market that recovery is generally 40 pence in the pound. That's just a market accepted norm. There are lots of default stats which you can readily get off Moody's and Fitch of what the likelihood of a BBB defaulting are. And in all honesty, they are low. I mean, if you're buying a shale gas producer who issued into the US dollar high yield market, and it was single D issue a rating, then the chances are you won't get your money back. But if you're lending money to Tesco, the chances are that there's not a solvency issue there. Sorry, I should point out as well, if you're looking at high yield bonds, it's the only time where spread is actually secondary to price, because the spread is actually so vast that everyone forgets the spread and just starts talking in price and yield.
And who are the main investors in the corporate bond market? It won't be retail.
So it's pension funds, all the main household names that you know. So probably everyone who's listening to this or who's kindly willing to listen to it, if they've got a pension, they will have their pension with somebody who is dealing in bonds all day, every day, and trying to make the best return they can. So pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, asset managers, hedge funds, bank trading desks are obviously trading all the time, and then prop desks historically. And then there's the outliers that, I mean, I spent my career being amazed at things. So when Taylor Woodrow and George Wimpey merged, I think it was 2005 or six, they had a load of private placements in issue, and I wanted to buy them because I thought they were the wrong price. It turned out they were held by Midwestern asset managers. And so we got on the phone to them and had a chat to them. Turned out they absolutely dwarfed at the time any UK asset manager that was in existence, and nobody had heard of them. And then we would randomly get calls from, I think I remember once that we had the Korean Post Office Pension Fund, who for a short time became our biggest counterparty because they thought that sterling bonds were cheap. So it's a global market with global interest.
And in terms of retail bond funds and fund managers, if we want to go the fund manager route, who would you recommend?
Well, throughout my career, I've probably seen every single household name as an investor up close and personal, and seen their trading style and trading history. I think they all share common traits. They're all passionate. They're all very hardworking. They're all very thoughtful. They're all trying to do their best for their investors. I think it's fair to say that it's probably best in terms of if you have a theme you want to access, say, for example, you'd like finance, financial bonds, or you'd like general corporates, then that is more the way to come at it. But all the household names that are out there, the Eric Holtz, the Sarge Vades, the Richard Woolnough, who runs still the biggest fund, Steve Snowden, they are all, and the Invesco guys, and more latterly people like 24, they are all very good. And all they do all day is look at bonds, so, or corporate bonds. They're not looking at anything else. They're not forming a view generally on rate risk or anything like that, or where the equity is. They will obviously be cognizant of it, but all they're trying to do is make the best return they can, like all fund managers. So there are, the household names are probably the safest ones. If you look at Richard Woolnough's fund, it is so vast now that, I mean, he benefited massively from avoiding banks in the great financial crisis, but it's now so vast, I mean, it's questionable how much he can move the needle, but he's still an exceptional fund manager. But there's one thing to say on probably bond ETFs, which are different to equity ETFs. So I think the main one is SLXX. Well, it is SLXX. There is a massive tracking error there. And why that is because in about 2010, there was a guy at Barclays trying to issue the ETF for SLXX. And he came to me and said, offer me a load of these bonds that are in the index. And I just said no. And he sort of stormed off and said, this is outrageous. Tell me who your boss is. I'm going to go and get him. There was a quick conversation in which I pointed out that if he wanted to underwrite my losses, because these were all street shorts, I was more than happy to sell them to him. But that is a severe problem, that you can't necessarily get in or out of the bonds which are in the ETF. So if we did have a massive sell-off and you were holding that ETF, and that is the thing that probably keeps the Bank of England and the Fed awake at night more than almost anything else, and that's why they were buying bond ETFs in the US. If the bond market sells off in a material way, then we are all in trouble, because there is no door big enough for them all to get out of.
So in distress times, is volatility in bonds as extreme as it can be in equities?
Relatively, yes. So if you look at AA, I mean, it's moved from 25% to 13%, up from whatever it was, 7%. That is a big move for a bond, because you have to remember that it's less risky than the equity. So kind of, if you use that much coin term, risk adjusted, the move is equal.
So for you, who's really experienced, do you trade in and on out of bonds like you do, like people do in equities, for the sort of risk on, risk off against macro events?
Having been a trader for my whole career, I'm acutely aware of sort of the potential to do that. But now I set myself the mandate to be more of an investor. I would prefer to take my risk on, risk off bets in the equity market. And I'd prefer to, I'm more focused on when an opportunity arises. So say, for example, the Provident Financial, I started looking at that last week. When Burford kicked off, I started looking at that and was trying to figure out whether it was a solvency issue or just a noise issue. And similarly with AA and RAC, events will drive you, and there are always events coming up. I mean, I look at that Hammerson bond and I think it actually doesn't look bad risk, because I don't think Hammerson's going to go bust.
And with your investment portfolio, what percentage is equities and what percentage is bonds? Do you do any equities?
I'm 75% bonds, bond-like instruments. So I have been building an equity portfolio, and that's what brought me into this world and meeting lots of interesting people that I've met at all these events. But probably my main focus remains the bonds, because they're bigger. And I'm just looking for opportunities all day, every day.
And I have to ask, so what's your investing return like?
So since I started on my own, I think it's just short of 19% annualized. This year, as of this morning, because rates rallied last night, I'm up about 8% year to date, and just short of 16% last year. I should just point out, Tamsin, that bond is actually a bond I own, and it was issued in 1890. I put that on there because it's a nice certificate, and it's backed by rolling stock and actual train lines in Canada. Sorry.
Interesting. So Peter Orban asks, very interesting session, looking at retail investor opportunities, could you offer more colour on any future risk of irredeemable bank preference shares in light of the Aviva debacle a few years ago?
Oh, interesting. So one of the biggest trades I've done this year is buying preference shares. I bought cumulative preference shares. I think that issue is dead in the water. The CEO at Aviva resigned on the back of it. If anyone was to try it, I think it would be Lloyds, because Lloyds are the most aggressive in terms of their engagement. But I think they're sufficiently frightened. And the FSA, I mean, there were letters to Treasury Select Committees about Aviva's actions, and Aviva had to compensate anyone who sold. So I think in the intermediate future, I think that issue is gone. And the way I've actually, you know, backed that view is I bought, my biggest trade this year has been buying cumulative preference shares.
And there are two questions around liquidity. Philip Dawson asks, how liquid are bonds, i.e. can I trade them easily if required? And Derek Doolittle asks, aren't bonds illiquid outside the orb for the small amounts for private investors?
Well, in answer to that question, they're illiquid unless someone wants to sell you something that you want to buy, which is the same as in the equity market. So if you were to identify a bond and on a given day, you know, I identified I wanted to buy John Lewis bonds a while ago, because I think the security is probably the King's Road shop, which is pretty good risk in my view. But no one would offer me the bonds. Now, I didn't try again, but on one day you might say, no, there is no one willing to do that. But you don't actually have to go around the market. You can get your stockbroker to phone an agency broker, of which they will know quite a few of them, which is different to the equity market or the retail market makers. You can leave them an order. So I wouldn't be frightened by the concept of liquidity, illiquidity, as stopping you from doing it if you find the right risk. You might be frustrated that you might not like the price. And there'll be days when people say no, but I mean, it's like the equity market. I would come on it a day when everyone wants to sell everything. If someone's got them on their book, they will let you have them very quickly.
And Paul Lavin asks, can we find out who owns bonds and in what proportion?
You can on Bloomberg, but it's always out of date. Because of filings, and it's never truly representative. But in most cases, you probably wouldn't care, because they will all be, so the top 10 of any bond, almost without ever looking at any, in the, if it's a sterling bond, will be M&G, Aviva, Legal & General, might be Norges or something like that. So in terms of relevance to, let's say, a small cap equity pool, you just wouldn't, it's not like you could affect change on it, unless you, let's say we were talking about AA and you saw that someone was building a position, then that might be a clue. But it's very difficult to deduce that information in real time without a lag.
And Ben Sharman asks, he says, thanks very much for the excellent presentation. Probably a basic question, but what's the meaning of non-cumulative or cumulative bonds?
Hi, Ben. So cumulative just means if they don't pay it, and I presume you mean with reference to preference shares, Ben, it's the same with some financial bonds. But if it's cumulative and they, so say the PRA had told them to told the insurers not to pay preference shares, cumulative would accumulate the coupons that they don't pay you. Non-cumulative means they wouldn't have to give you them, the ones that were missed. So to my mind, the difference between cumulative and non-cumulative, if you're talking in preference land, is about 70 basis points, as in cumulative are more expensive by 70 basis points. So if a cumulative trades at 7% and a non-cumulative trades at a little over 7%, I think I'd rather own that cumulative risk, just because if something to happen in a very unsure world, then I, for an extra 70 odd basis points is not worth the risk.
And Dan Pearson asks, any comments on floating coupons?
As in floaters, it's a product that I actually never traded. The concept is good, but they're mostly issued by banks. It's not an area I would necessarily have a view on, but I think you've got to take a view on where you think rates are going, which I certainly don't know. And if I was buying one, I'd probably want to buy a good quality issuer.
And Mark Lauber says, very interesting, thanks. You mentioned that gains on QCBs are free of capital gains tax, but there are also rules around deep discount securities in the gain on a 5% coupon bond trading at, say, 50 and maturing at 100 might be taxed as income anyway. Can you give some colour on the interaction between QCB and deep discount security rules?
Oh, jeepers, you're testing me there, Mark. I think it has to be issued as a... So the reason that that legislation occurred is because people figured out, or rather clever banks figured out, they could issue very cheap bonds, subpar value, and give them a capital gain, which then enabled people to benefit from the non-tax gain. But the reality is that that quickly was stopped, and that's why they put that legislation in whatever finance act it was. But we're talking about a plain vanilla corporate bond that, due to reasons of the market moving, goes below par. So yeah, if it was issued as a deeply discounted, yes, you are taxed. But most of the bonds that you will look at nowadays are not issued as deeply discounted, they're issued at par. So the clue is looking at what price it was issued at.
So I think someone here, well, I think Jim Howe wants to you to manage his money. He's saying, do you plan to accept any outside money into your fund?
Thank you, Jim. Very kind of you to say. I'm not regulated, so I can't do that. My plan was always to launch a hedge fund. In all honesty, it's a very expensive endeavor, and whether I would be successful is a big question that I spend lots of days asking myself. So watch this space.
Stephen Hall asks, could you recommend any good primer books or guides or internet sites on bonds?
I think there's, I mean, I recall that someone used to do a website called Fixed Income Investor, where they put all the gilt prices and a lot of bond prices. I think if you were to type sterling corporate, I actually wrote one, but I've since lost it for bank clients. I think there is, the power of Google is incredible. What I would say to that, Stephen, is don't be fazed. It's a simple thing. Essentially, you give someone your money in the form of you buy that bond. You are just figuring out whether you get your money back. Don't let the usual sort of financial community desire to use lots of terminology to blind you with science. Think about it in those terms and then think, do I like that issuer? But I think you'll find a lot on Google.
And John Cockrell asks, what might a model portfolio of 100,000 look like for a retail investor? And would a 1 million portfolio look the same but bigger? Or would it introduce different elements?
I think a £1 million portfolio demands that you can use, or demands and requires you use specific bond issuers, whereas 100,000, you might take the view that if you could buy a bond investment trust in a sector you like, say for example, reality is I've been buying a bond fund by 24 Asset Management because I liked subordinated financial risk when it was really kicking off, and I couldn't actually get offers in the stuff I wanted to buy in the bond market. So for £100,000, if an investment trust is trading at a discount, then I might be more inclined, because it's quite time intensive if you're going to sit down and read a prospectus. But for £1 million, you might want to buy 10 bonds, and you might want differing sectors, you might want differing yield targets. So I think the number that you were willing to look at would demand how much time, or rather you would have to answer to yourself how much time you're willing to give to it.
And Andrew Council asks, outside the orb, how can a retail investor identify what the minimum quantity is that can be purchased in a particular bond? Obviously, he doesn't have access to Bloomberg.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say most people don't. The reason the minimum denoms exist now is because of MiFID II, and it just has stopped issuers having to issue very lengthy, even more lengthy documents. And that is to the detriment of us all as investors, and it's a real shame. I think if you Google any bond, say if you were to Google Hammerson, that bond I showed, 7.25-28, you can get to the free website CBonds, and that will have the minimum denomination on there. And also you can go to the issuer website. So Tesco has every single bond, I think, that they've ever issued, as does most issuers like Nationwide or Lloyds Bank or any of the big issuers. So that Provident Financial, I haven't checked, but they will probably have them on their website. And you can quickly pull up the prospectus. You don't need to read it all. You just do Control F and type in minimum denomination. So there is a little bit of work, but it depends. I mean, as an asset class, I think all investors, probably certainly as we age, should be looking more at it, especially even more so now dividend income is challenged.
And Jay Shah asks, if you were going to buy one of Aviva, Burford or Provident Financial bonds, which would you go for?
I don't have a view on Aviva bonds. I have a view on Aviva preference shares, which I have been buying. What was the third one? I've got Aviva,
Burford and Provident Financial. Burford.
Of those three,
yes.
Right here, right now, I would probably buy Aviva Prefs.
Interesting.
Aviva bond issue. I mean, there's probably 50 of them, so from senior to subordinated. But I mean, all three. I mean, Provident is probably yielding 8-11%. Burford, I think, at the moment, the shorter dated one is yielding nearly 9%. When I last looked at it. Whereas the preference share is about probably 6%. So, but the preference share is probably the least likely for anything untoward to happen.
And Ben Roebuck asks, can you buy and hold a specific corporate bond, for example, AA, within an ISA?
I think the rules are defined. It has to be in excess of 5 years. Is the rule I can remember. Most, if you were to phone a stockbroker, they can quickly tell you. I think Hargreaves Lansdown, stockbroker websites always have bond information as well, as does the London Stock Exchange website. Sorry, I should have said that. They will be able to tell you immediately whether it's ISAable, because there's a flag put on every, there's lots of financial information for any bond, and there's flags which tell it if it's ISAable or non-ISAable.
And Shalene Patel asks, just for context, what sort of drawdown did you see mid-March? It's a useful gauge for a comparison for most investors who run purely equity portfolios.
The first thing to say, Shalene, is the volatility was vast, but remember that you've got rate risk in there. So what actually happened is spreads widened out, but government bonds rallied out of sight. So the government bond yield rallied. So even on bad days when my credit was losing money, I was finding that quite often the rate rally was protecting me from the downside. Now, that's an entirely different topic about rate risk versus credit risk. But for the last 35 years, rates have been rallying. And for the last 35 years, every strategist I've sat next to has said, don't buy government bonds because they're going to collapse, and every year they've rallied out of sight, and then they escalated in March. So you know, the big hedge funds, of which play in them, made, I mean, I think Brevan Howard made 100%. They were basically betting on being long government bonds as much as anything else, I would suspect, and they rallied out of sight.
And Tom Porter asks, how does a retail investor start a portfolio of individual bonds? Do you have a recommended platform, and would transaction costs be too high if you started with, say, £10,000?
Transaction costs aren't too high because they charge you the same as they do for an equity, but you generally have to phone up. The first thing to say back to that is, what are you actually trying to achieve? Are you trying to solve for a yield? And then come at it the other way, like what is your end game? Because if you are buying AA bonds, you would be locked out because of the minimum denomination issue. But if you're buying a preference share, you'd be locking in 6% for theoretically perpetuity. So I would come at it more like, what do I actually want to achieve, to answer that question and solve? I mean, if it's that my equity return that I'm seeking is 10%, then theoretically you could buy a bond that could answer that question. You not have to do anything, but that would require you to then go away and actually figure out what that bond was and whether you like that risk, which is, you know, it's not an inconsiderable amount of work. But theoretically, in buying that bond, you are taking less risk than if you were buying a similar equity. I mean, I heard on Radio 4 the other week, I almost sort of spat my tea out when I heard the commentator say people aren't buying quality corporate bonds there because they're too risky. They're buying low-risk equities. And I just thought, you don't understand the capital structure, because that's just completely at odds with the reality. So answer the question for yourself first, and then you know, Twitter's a great resource. I'm on Twitter. You can ask me any question you want. I'll have a view on it. But perhaps talk to your stockbroker as well. Ask him to send you a list of all bonds as a starting point.
And Paul Heaton asks, why do you think the IG bond market typically reacts more slowly than the equity market to increase risk? For example, Dignity AA into equity was all in free fall when the bonds were largely static until the issues hit home.
I'm not sure that AA bonds were static before the equity. I think Dignity is fair to say, but there is many cases where the bond market leads. So say, for example, late 2008, bond spreads were screaming that there was a big problem and the equity market kept making new highs. Individual stories, perhaps reflective of the investor base. I mean, Dignity is a whole business securitization. I think AA did react, but I couldn't say that for a fact. So I would say in many cases, the bond market is as much as a leader indicator as a lagging indicator. And it is very specific as to when it is.
Great. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Paul, thanks ever so much. Where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter. I think it's a fabulous universe. So send me a tweet, ask me a question. I'll always talk bonds with anybody.
And what's your Twitter handle?
It's @Hawkeye_74.
Fantastic. Paul, thanks ever so much for a superb webinar. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, go to the right-hand side of the homepage at piworld.co.uk. There are two boxes. The top, sign up for a notification of a new video as it's published, and underneath, sign up for events. They're different lists and there's no spam. And please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting really good speakers relies on you and the audience numbers we attract. You can find me on Twitter at @TamsinPIWorld. Many thanks to Paul, and many thanks to you all for joining us, and stay well. Goodbye for now.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.